Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Rob Wolf, and welcome one more time to Unformatable, where we look back at some of the less heralded but still unique players in Mets history, as every player who dons the orange and blue is, in their own way, unformatable. So the calm before the late season storm right now, the Mets got through a 500 week on the road, still in that wild card hunt. Very exciting. Based on where we were a month ago, to have that as a thing. So I'm just trying to be optimistic about it. Going out to Citi Field this week to get my first chance to see Marcus Stroman in a Met uniform, which I'm very excited about. Very electric player to watch. It's always funny, with Steven Matz, now Stroman, even the recently acquired Joe Panik. Just always seems to be a little extra juice or a little extra interest around the quote-unquote local Mets. Although I do take a slight problem with that, because geography be damned. Long Island really ain't Queens or New York City, is it? My friend Bob always likes to tell me when I say I live in Brooklyn, he's like, you live on Long Island. And I'm like, geographically, fine, but no, miles away. No offense to everyone in Long Island, just different places. I mean, heck, Joe Panik was born in Yonkers, where my family moved from the Bronx as a kid. It's close to the city, but I always knew it was not quite the city. At any rate, today's unformidable Met may have been born in Passaic, New Jersey, but he was raised in Bayside, Queens, and he attended Francis Lewis High School, or Franny Lou, as I believe the natives called it, where my ex-girlfriend went once upon a time. Hi, Flo. Who am I kidding? You're not listening. But anyway, it was perhaps inevitable that Mike Jorgensen would be drafted by the New York Mets, eyeing the hometown boy out of Franny Lou High School, out of old Francis Lewis High School, in 1966, when the Mets drafted him in the fourth round. And this will be a fun and circuitous, if you will, unformatable, because I've been trying to really structure these. It kind of makes sense to me logically, or as Brian had suggested to me to structure it, pre-Mets, tenure with the Mets, post-Mets, obviously, depending on the player and their career, you might get a lot more of one or the other, what was notable in their career. But Mike Jorgensen, as many of you may know, had more than one tenure with the Mets, so we'll be following his journey from the Mets away and back and away again. So away we go. So after being drafted in 1966, young Mike Jorgensen went straight from high school to the Mets organization. He was decent in the minors, it seemed, statistically speaking, but not world-beating by any stretch of the imagination. But he did jump straight from AA to the majors and was a young 20 years old when he made his major league debut on September 10th, 1968. Gotten about 8 games down the stretch that year, pinch hitting and playing first base, went 2-for-14. He recorded his first major league hit on September 14th against the Pittsburgh Pirates, a pitcher named Bob Veal. The game was a 6-0 Mets defeat in which Roberto Clemente would take Tom Seaver deep twice. Now, perhaps you may have heard, but 1969 was a far different season for the till then perennially struggling New York Met franchise. So while Jorgie was excellent in AAA Tidewater. He put up a 904 OPS, hit 21 home runs, which is a number he'd never see in the majors. The 21-year-old spent the entire 69 season in AAA, never appearing with the world champion Mets or earning, getting in a playoff game or earning a ring. The big club would acquire Don Clendenin to fill their first base void to that veteran presence. And, well, we can't knock the veteran presence there. It certainly worked, as Mr. Clendenin notably won the World Series MVP. And he also had a great 1970 with the Mets. Jorgensen was on the major league team pretty much all through the 1970 and 71 seasons, as those Mets teams struggled to reach those world championship heights again. They finished 83 and 79 each year, but as a team that was going for it in going for it mode, the young player was primarily a first base outfield backup. Behind Clendenin in 70, Ed Cranepool in 71, getting a little time in the outfield behind the E.G. Jones Swoboda group. But in those two seasons, he only got into 121 games and recorded 205 at-bats, and he hit 195 and 220 in those seasons. So the young New Yorker never really got a big opportunity with basically a club trying to capitalize on a championship window built largely around young pitching. That's a classic Mets story, isn't it? Anyway, right before the start of the 1972 season, the Mets sent the still only 22-year-old Jorgensen to Montreal. Jorgensen became an expo along with Tim Foley and Ken Singleton as the Mets brought in Le Grand Orange Rusty Staub. At the time of the trade, Jorgensen recalls being, quote, pretty devastated. There's actually a great Anthony McCarron article in the Daily News about 4 or 5 years back where he tracked down and interviewed Jorgensen, and interviewed him about his time with the Mets, and it stands to reason he'd be pretty devastated. Young man playing in his hometown, he lived with his parents at the time of the trade, and had a nice 5-mile commute to Shea Stadium. But Jorgensen did note, he said, if I'd known I'd be on 6 clubs eventually, I wouldn't have been so down. I was young. It gave me a chance to play every day. It was a nice trade for all of us. And that's probably a pretty fair assessment. The trade from the Mets was certainly not the end of Jorgie's baseball journey or his journey as a New York Met, not by a long shot. While a fractured wrist would derail much of Rusty Staub's 1972 season with the Mets, he was, of course, a productive and pretty beloved Met, one of the best players on that 1973 championship NL Champions team the following year. Of course, Ken Singleton would become the player the Mets would ultimately regret trading most of all, although, again, they did at least acquire a player of great note and value in Staub. But while Singleton would go on to become an all-star player, Jorgensen would have some solid years of his own as a Montreal expo. In Montreal, with an even more expansion franchise than the New York Mets, than a good 10 years into existence, 11, Jorgensen is pretty much an everyday player for the expos from 72 to 77, primarily as a first baseman, although again he would move to the outfield from time to time, which I just see from games played. It was kind of curious because he earned a reputation as one of the best defensive first basemen in baseball, winning the 1973 Gold Glove. He was the first expo to win that award. Always funny, I remember the expos so fondly. It just still burns me that their records are tied up with the Washington Nationals now. It's just wrong. But overall, as a ball player, Jorgensen seemed to have a reputation as a defensive first baseman, which supplemented with a really good batting eye, but not a ton of power. Bit of an anomaly for a first baseman, of course. His eye certainly, especially when in those expos years, helped him record some productive seasons. For his career, Jorgensen walked 532 times versus only 589 strikeouts. In the best season of his career in 1974, that ratio was absolutely astonishing. 70 walks versus 39 strikeouts. 74 was an incredibly anomalous year for him. I mean, you know, if it was a steroid era, you'd probably start questioning him. Not saying anything about you, Mike Jorgensen. Never imply that, but it just, you know, really just jumps out. I don't even think it was his quote-unquote age 27 season. I think he was probably even younger than that. But he hit a career high 310, recorded a 931 OPS and a 156 OPS plus, reaching double digit home runs for one of only three seasons in his career. I mean, he hit 261 the following season, which is also a very good season for him overall, but that's the next highest batting average he recorded, where he had more than like 50 plate appearances in a season. So it was really 74 was really the peak. He did hit a career high 18 home runs in 1975. It was an interesting stat line. He didn't hit for a lot of doubles. He had 18 homers in 75. He also hit 18 doubles. Both of those are career highs in those categories. He had 95 career home runs, only 132 career doubles. Just, I don't know, kind of a lightish hitting defensive first baseman with a good eye. Dave Magadan-esque. I don't know. No, Dave Magadan hit for a much better average, I think.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Amanda.
We get to tell everyone about the new pod, Eater's Digest.
Eater's Digest. That is right. Our brand new podcast. It is available now.
It's everything you need to know about the world of food every week with a little help from the biggest names in the industry and food journalists from the Eater Newsroom.
We're going to talk about everything from the worst things that diners do in restaurants to fake meat. We're going to talk about food delivery tech. We are going to argue a lot about how to best behave in restaurants.
Oh yeah, big time. So many things. I mean, there's nothing we can't touch.
Food and politics?
Food and politics, maybe. Yes, food and politics comes up.
Yep.
It might make you laugh. It might make you think. It might even make you hungry, Daniel.
So subscribe to Eater's Digest for free today on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
At any rate, Jorgensen got traded from the Expos to the A's in the 77 season. He had very little playing time with both teams, and then the 77 offseason signed with the Rangers, as Texas Rangers, as a free agent. He would play nine more seasons, but he was almost primarily a backup. If you look at his numbers over the next nine seasons, he averaged about 150 at-bats a season in his various stops. His time with the Rangers was very uneventful statistically, but it's worth noting because of an on-field incident that... It's one of the first things you'll find if you Google or look up Mike Jorgensen. On May 28th of 1979 with Texas, Jordan was batting against Andy Hassler of the Red Sox. Pitch was thrown actually behind him, and you know, as he flinched and ducked out of the way, he ducked right into it and got hit square in the head. Days later, Jorgensen had bad headaches and was taken to the hospital. While at the hospital, he passed out and went into convulsions. It was discovered they had a blood clot in his brain, and they had to administer oxygen immediately. And you know, according to reports that I read online, if that hadn't happened, Jorgensen would have joined Ray Chapman as the only major leaguer to die as a result of being hit by a pitch. So it was a very scary moment, obviously, for Jorgensen, and one we'll discuss briefly. Was his return to the Mets that he naturally, clearly never forgot. So Jorgie came back home after the 1979 season, after that scary incident. The Mets had made a deadline trade with the Rangers where they sent them Willie Montanez for a couple of players to be named later. Jorgensen joined Ed Lynch as those players, those PTBNLs. And back to the Mets, Mike Jorgensen came. Jorgensen played a decent bit in 80 for a very poor Mets team and had one of the most memorable moments of his career on June 11th, 1980. Came in as a defensive replacement in the ninth inning of a game. And in the bottom of the 10th, off of then-young reliever Rick Sutcliffe, Mike Jorgensen clobbered a game-winning walk-off grand slam in the bottom of the 10th. It was, that 80s team wound up being quite bad, although at the time, you know, I think they brought the record to 25 and 27, and, you know, after a couple of incredibly bleak years, you know, people had some hope, I think, that quickly faded in 1980, but it seems like a very memorable game at Shea. Craig Swan was the winning pitcher, going all 10 innings to record the victory. You don't see that much anymore, of course. And if my very perfunctory research is accurate, it is one of only 7 walk-off grand slams in Mets history. No, that does not count Robin Ventura, unfortunately. We'll always remember it all the more fondly for it not being a walk-off grand slam, but it seemed to be the second. The first was Tim Harkness in 1963, Mike Jorgensen, and since Jorgie, I counted Tim Tuffle, Kevin McReynolds, Ike Davis, Danny Valdespin, and Joey Batts last year. If anyone remembers any others or can find any others, please let me know, but quite the list. In that McCarran article I mentioned before, Jorgensen still remembered every detail. He said, high fastball, 2-2 count, you don't hit many grand slams, so you remember it. And he does remember it as one of the better moments of his career. A little later that season, in July, Jorgensen came to bat immediately after Joel Youngblood hit a 2-run homer off of Bill Gullickson of the Expos, and Gullickson threw a 0-2 pitch at Jorgensen's head that Jorgensen thought, I think, had clear intent. And obviously, remembering his experiences before, you know, which I think was much rarer in 1980, he started out towards the mound pointing his bat at Gullickson. Jorgensen was restrained by Montreal catcher John Tamargo, but apparently John Stearns came charging out of the dugout and football tackled Gullickson and initiated what was a, you know, pretty large, maybe not 1986 style, but a pretty impressive bench clearing brawl, I think. Anyone who remembers John Stearns' enthusiasm in the 2000 playoffs as hitting coach, if not his incredible enthusiasm as a ball player, which I remember, probably won't be too surprised by that story. But in 1980, 119 games, 321 at-bats. Last year, I'd say he got any regular playing time as a starter. He hung around baseball from 81 to 85, he never recorded much more than 120 at-bats in a season thereafter, 124 actually being the high. And Jorgensen became dispensable to the Mets on a very notable day in Mets history, June 15th, 1983, when Keith Hernandez came to the Mets. The Mets sold Jorgensen's contract to the Atlanta Braves. He spent a full season with the Braves. He spent June 15th, 1983 to June 15th, 1984. And at that trade deadline in 84, the Braves sent him and Ken Daly to the St. Louis Cardinals for Ken Obergefell. So the Queens boy became a Cardinal in 1984 and 1985, where he got to participate in that intense rivalry for those two seasons. And Jorgensen would actually get his only postseason experience in 1985. His last baseball experience was in the postseason in an NLCS and a World Series that really should have involved the Mets. But so it goes. So it too often goes for Mets fans, right? Jorgensen went 0-2 in the LCS and 0-3 in the World Series as a pinch hitter, as the Cardinals beat the Dodgers in the 85 NLCS and lost to the Kansas City Royals in the 1985 World Series. For his career, Mike Jorgensen appeared in 1,633 games, recorded 3,421 at-bats. She recorded a nice little 9.1 war, according to Baseball Reference. 95 career home runs, so close to 100. Hit 243, 347 on base percentage. Again, you know, great batting eye. Only a 373 slugging percentage, you know, not ideal from a first baseman slash outfielder. His 720 OPS, and he had a 101 OPS plus for his career. So, you know, long career as a, you know, pretty much average major league hitter, certainly to be commended. Unfortunately, his Met numbers were not as impressive. He recorded a negative 0.6 war, according to Baseball Reference, in his 492 games and 800 at-bats as a Met. 234 batting average, 682 OPS. And if you thought Mike Jorgensen was the enemy in 84 and 85, if you remember those seasons, he's been in that Cardinal organization pretty much ever since. Dal Maxville was the Cardinal GM in 1985 and told Jorgensen he wouldn't be offered a contract in 86, but he did offer him a role in the organization as a minor league hitting instructor, and Jorgensen's role with the Cardinals has pretty much continued unabated since. He worked his way up to minor league hitting coordinator in 90 and 91, and then served for 10 years as the Cardinals' director of player development, aside from an interlude in 1995 that I had zero recollection of, and I'll be impressed if anyone else does. But following Joe Torre being fired as manager of the Cardinals in 1995, Jorgensen finished the season. I didn't even remember that he was fired in season, but Mike Jorgensen managed the Cardinals for the last half of the 1995 season, leading St. Louis to a 42-54 one-loss record. When I googled Mike Jorgensen and I saw a managerial record, I was like, what the hell are they talking about? But I imagine if you looked up a list of Cardinal managers, you would see Mike Jorgensen nestled in between Joe Torre and Tony La Russa. And oh, how I'd hate to be nestled between those two people in any way, shape, or form. Anyway, when La Russa was hired, Jorgensen went back to director of player development, and basically since 2001 has served as a senior assistant to the Cardinals general manager, primarily scouting the American League. But Met fans of two generations can have some kind of fond memories of Mike Jorgensen, I would hope, especially, you know, that 80s vintage, you know, some people might remember the walk-off grand slam, Mike Jorgensen and the Catch the Rising Stars Mets of the early 80s, although he was certainly not one of the rising stars by then, but is part of that pre-great 80s teams era of hope. Or we might just remember Bob Murphy constantly telling us that Mike Jorgensen was born on the same day that Babe Ruth died, August 16th, 1948. Which, you know, he unfortunately did not prove to be Babe Ruth reincarnate, but he did prove to be a fine major league ball player and an unformidable New York Met. So thank you for taking the time to listen to this tale of Jorgie. And thank you, as always, for listening to Unformidable. Please go to AmazonAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. Follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify. Please subscribe and leave a review. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, W-O-L-F-F-R-R, and the show is at Unformidable. Thank you, and let's go Mets.
Are you troubled by strange hockey trades in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread about NHL free agency?
Have you or your family ever seen a New York Islanders game?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your mobile device and subscribe to Lighthouse Hockey Podcast from SB Nation today.
Our courteous and efficient hosts are ready to serve all of your Islander needs and worries.
Lighthouse Hockey Podcasts for New York Islanders fans.
Hi, I'm Amanda Clute, editor-in-chief of Eater.
And I am Daniel Janine, a producer here at Eater.
And we are here to tell you about our brand new podcast, Eater's Digest.
Every week on the show, we dive into the weirdest, funniest, and most important stories in the world of food.
With the inside scoop from the biggest names in the industry and expert insights from the Eater newsroom.
It's a really fun time, so I would say subscribe to Eater's Digest for free today on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.